Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 12th of April. On this day, 151 years ago, the Civil War started at Fort Sumter. In this hour of the program, we're going to be talking about the start of the Civil War and the battles that came after. What happened before this day still astounds me. Abraham Lincoln was elected president, as you well know, in 1860. In December of 1860, South Carolina seceded. Then it was Mississippi, Florida, Alabama, Georgia, Louisiana, Texas, and after today, Virginia, Arkansas, North Carolina, and Tennessee. How the president responded to all of this has been a source of endless fascination for me. We have two guests with us this hour. Rick Hatcher is a historian at Fort Sumter National Monument, and he has done a great deal of work concerning the Civil War. He began his career with the National Park Service as a volunteer and a seasonal employee at Richmond National Battlefield Park in 1970. He also has worked at Kings Mountain National Military Park in South Carolina, Wilson's Creek National Battlefield in Missouri, where he was the historian, and at Fort Sumter National Monument since 1992. He has written and published widely about Wilson's Creek and about Fort Sumter and Moultrie, and has been involved in telling these stories for many, many years. Rick, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Yeah, Jess. Pleasure to have you with us. Also joining us is Lance Hertigan. Lance has joined us before. He is chair of the Wisconsin Civil War 150th Commission. He's a former director of the Institute of Civil War Studies at Carroll University and author most recently of Those Damned Black Hats, The Iron Brigade in the Gettysburg Campaign. We had a memorable interview with him about that book not that long ago. Lance, thank you for joining us once again.
Hey, it's always fun.
Yeah, nice to have you here. Do you know Rick?
No, I don't believe so.
All right, well, you'll know
nice
him.
Nice to see you, Rick.
Nice to meet you as well.
You'll know him after this hour. We also have posted on our Facebook a question, because when we last talked to Lance, we heard many stories from you about ancestors of yours who served in the Civil War from Wisconsin. If you have memories that you would like to share, you can post them on Facebook at the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we will get to them. Let's start with just the months that preceded what happened today at Fort Sumter. It just always astounds me to look at what this president was facing even before he took the oath of office. All of these states seceding, and South Carolina, Rick, was the first to do so. Can you give us that background?
Well, of course, with the election of Lincoln in November of 1860, there have been saber-rattling in the Deep South for some time concerning the issue. And with Lincoln's election, South Carolina took the lead, and then officially on December 20th of 1860 seceded from the Union in Charleston, signing the Ordinance of Secession.
And tell us about Fort Sumter. I was shady on the background here. Fort Sumter was built as a response in some ways to the War of 1812?
Yes. Not just Fort Sumter, but a good number of forts along the American coastline, from Fort Preble in Maine down to Fort Jefferson at Dry Tortugas in the Florida Keys, all the way out to Fort Point under the Golden Gate Bridge. The United States was woefully indefensible as a result of the War of 1812. The government realized that and began a program of building a system of new coastal fortifications to guard the nation against another invasion from the sea. And so Charleston Harbor was selected to receive one of those new forts and to be named Fort Sumter.
And to steep us deep in history, tell us what happened at the place where you are right now, 151 years ago, at 4:30 this morning.
Well, there would be a whole lot of shooting going on right now, as we would say. There were 43 Confederate guns surrounding the fort, and they fired upon the fort starting at 4:30 in the morning. At about 7 o'clock that morning, the garrison in Fort Sumter started to respond to that bombardment by returning fire. The bombardment would last for 34 hours with over 3,000 heavy rounds of ammunition being fired at the fort.
And Lance, how would we have and when did we hear the news in Wisconsin of what had happened at Fort Sumter?
Well, it's not like you could turn on your television and get actual pictures of the firing. So it took a long time to get to Wisconsin. And most people heard of the firing on Fort Sumter when they went to church on the Sunday following. And as a result of it, it was pretty much of a shock. In other words, the pastors announced from the church pulpit that the fort had been fired upon. And the reaction was at first mixed, and first anger, and then sort of quiet. One Wisconsin man said the stillness in the streets of the small towns in midday was chilling, he said, because it foretold of a coming storm.
And what a storm it was, and people didn't know at that moment how all of them were going to be affected, and certainly the whole state was. We're going to call you back, Lance. We'll put this question to Rick and call you back. Our line is a little bit shady with you. Rick, the other thing that was happening, and I think about Lincoln quite frequently, actually, at this moment. Here was a president who people didn't know who he was. They didn't have a whole lot of confidence in him. He has all these states that have seceded from the Union, for heaven's sake, before he even takes office. What a job he has to instill confidence and to come up with a plan.
Right. He had to go on a massive learning curve. Of course, he had only served in the United States Congress for one 2-year term. He was from the West and was very much unknown. He wasn't from an established political background with the establishments of with the new Republican Party and with the formation of the party. So, you know, he had been a Whig before, so he was an unknown. And there was some thought among some of the formers and founders of the Republican Party that they could pretty much control him and really lead the nation, and he would be kind of a figurehead to a degree. I think Seward thought that for the most part, but they would soon realize that how savvy he was and how quickly he learned and grew into the position of the president.
Historian of Lincoln has said that the weeks leading up to the firing on Fort Sumter were nothing less than a horrific nightmare for the neophyte president. I'll bet they were a nightmare.
Right, and once again, and as was Lance mentioned, you know, it could take hours or even days for the information of what was going on here to reach Washington, and then in turn for there to be a response and then make it back to Fort Sumter. So, you know, there are these long delay periods, and the situation could be very fluid here in Charleston and change very quickly. And so there was always this constant delay in getting information that's going to be, you know, could very well be days old, and then how are you going to respond to that?
Mm-hmm. Did families and young men in the state of Wisconsin immediately say, this is atrocious, I'm going to march off to war, which is inevitable? Lance?
Yeah, that's some of it. One farmer hired man said the talk turned to war, 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 and they wanted to hang the secessionists to the nearest tree. And there was this swirl of emotion that went through the state as it became common knowledge of Fort Sumter. And, of course, that immediately set off a desire to enlist.
Did the Confederates in South Carolina think that Fort Sumter was theirs, and how would they have claimed such?
Well, you know, they viewed that they had a right to secession, that the states had joined the Union willingly, and that they could also leave willingly if they thought, you know, they thought they had the right to do that. But from a perspective here, with the secession of the 7 states of the Deep South and the formation of the Confederacy, Charleston was the most important seaport on the South Atlantic coast of this new country.
Mm.
And so they are going to rely on getting their cotton, rice, tobacco out on ships to foreign ports and bring goods and material in. Now, how can they do that if now a foreign power, the United States, holds Fort Sumter, which controls the shipping channel leading in and out of Charleston Harbor. And also, if they wanted to be viewed as a legitimate government by England, France, etc., how can they be looked upon as a legitimate and viable entity if they can't control the shipping going in and out of their most important harbor on the Atlantic coast of their new country? And how can ships feel they can come in without fear of possibly being stopped from that by now fire from United States artillery in Fort Sumter? So, you know, politically, diplomatically, the symbol of the United States forces in Fort Sumter can be very embarrassing for the Confederacy and for this legitimacy of wanting to be recognized as a new country.
Mm-hmm.
So it's more than just what's going on and what's viewed upon it here in the United States and in the Confederate States. It's how this is going to look internationally as well.
The negotiations that took place here are rather interesting because the soldiers who were at Fort Sumter were near the end of their food supply, is my understanding, and that there was a need to resupply the troops. Can you tell me what happened in that regard, the negotiations that took place between the Confederate government of Charleston and the government in Washington?
Well, once again, Lincoln and his administration did not recognize the Confederacy and would not talk to them. So Lincoln would send his communications down to Governor Francis Pickens of South Carolina, who had been elected governor of South Carolina before secession. So politically, legally, Lincoln could communicate with him and not directly with any Confederates. So the messages would be sent from the War Department, from Lincoln in Washington, down to Governor Francis Pickens, who then in return would relay that information to Confederate authorities. Here directly would be Confederate General P.G.T. Beauregard. So that's how the communications were being done. But once again, we're playing this game of, you know, we can't recognize the Confederacy. That will give them a look upon them as some type of legality or some type of being recognized by the United States government. So, you know, they're playing this. There's kind of a game going on here in that regard. But that's how things were communicated. And that's how Lincoln communicated to the Confederates down here that he is sending this relief expedition down, and that one, he's just going to deliver food to hungry soldiers. And if that was opposed, then he would try to bring in food and reinforce it with more troops and military goods. So that's where the pinch comes in, where the Confederates view that they cannot have this continue to drag on. It's going on month after month, that this has got to come to an end. And so this is when the Confederate emissaries go out to Fort Sumter and make a final evacuation demand to Major Anderson, and Anderson refuses that, and he is told that then we will open fire upon you at 4:30 in the morning. And the Confederate emissaries go back, and, of course, the war begins with that mortar shell being fired at 4:30 in the morning on April the 12th.
Lance, it has been said by some historians that Lincoln believed the conflict was inevitable and devised a plan that would cause the Confederates to fire the first shot. Do you agree with that?
Well, he was being very savvy in this regard, and a lot of people view upon it. He kind of put the Confederates kind of painted them back into a corner where if they back down, you know, they could lose face. How are they going to be recognized as legitimate? And once again, from the Confederate viewpoint, this is the most important seaport we have on the Atlantic coast of our country. We cannot have now what they view a foreign power, the United States, controlling the shipping that can come in and out of our harbor. And we can't have this stalemate continue and continue and continue. And interestingly, you know, as you go a little bit further in this, there's a similar situation going on at Fort Pickens in Pensacola Harbor in Florida. And the United States forces will hold that for the entire war. And then with the secession of Virginia, Fort Monroe will remain in United States hands throughout the entire war. So you know, the situation is that, you know, the United States is not completely out of the Confederate States of America, even with secession in the beginning of the war. They will hold on to two installations, but the war begins here at Fort Sumter when this becomes the tipping point.
Mm-hmm. And as the war begins, Lance, how does the president frame the reason for fighting?
Well, I think he was trying to... I think he had a couple of issues, and one of the issues was, of course, the fact that he had a pretty diverse Republican Party in a really broken up administration at that point, and he needed some sort of a unification. He needed to unify that, especially if he was going to fight a war. He never quite lost the idea that it was the Southerners that were really pushing a start of an armed conflict. He said in his inaugural address, he said, it's up to you, basically, whether we are going to fight and we shouldn't fight. So when the war starts and Sumter is fired upon, it's a great boon for the Lincoln administration because he now can unify his party, rally the North against the South, and the conflict to do all the things he needed to do to mount an army.
And was that easily done? Was it easy to rally the troops?
Oh, you didn't have any trouble at all. I mean, in Wisconsin, they offered up six regiments. They were required to provide 1,000-man regiment for the war. That was our quota in Wisconsin, and they had six regiments were offered from the state almost immediately.
Oh, my.
The problem, of course, is what do you do for uniforms and belts and shoes and tents and all the things that are needed?
Right. And what about in the Confederacy? How did they rally the troops and frame the issue of why war?
Well, they were looking upon themselves as defending themselves then from an invasion. So with the firing on Fort Sumter, of course, that swept across, the news of that swept across the Deep South, and many more troops started to come forward, and our citizens came forward to serve in the military. And then, of course, when President Lincoln called for 75,000 volunteers to suppress the rebellion, and his call for troops was based on the 1860 census. Each state was allocated to provide X number of regiments or troops depending on its population. So when the call went out then for Virginia, North Carolina, Tennessee, Arkansas to supply troops to suppress the rebellion, this is when these states, that tipped it for those states to secede from the Union and join the Confederacy, because they said that they would not provide troops to invade their sister southern states. And then the issue comes up with Missouri and Kentucky. I know, since I used to live in Missouri, Missouri was requested to provide four regiments of infantry for the U.S. Army. And the governor of Missouri, who was pro-Confederate, said, not one man will the state of Missouri provide to carry on such an unholy cause. So he rejected that notification from the War Department in Washington. So a tipping point for the Upper South was Lincoln's call for the 75,000 volunteers to suppress the rebellion, once again forcing Virginia, North Carolina, Tennessee, and Arkansas to make that decision. Do we stay in the Union? Do we secede? So they seceded because of that issue from the president.
You know, I listened to both of you. We're going to go to phone calls in a moment, and I still can't believe all of this happened. What a profound thing to have happen in our country, isn't it? I mean, isn't it just remarkable?
Oh, yes, ma'am, it is.
I think so, too. I think, you know, there's a long trail leading up to that moment, though. Of course, there's been friction between the states very early over the slavery issue, especially in Wisconsin, where we had a very active resistance to the fugitive slave law, which allowed federal authorities to come into Wisconsin and recapture runaway slaves.
Mm-hmm.
And so this has been going on for a long time. And I think people were surprised that the war actually happened, because there had been so many false threats and arguments and moments of irritation, but it was really that issue that kept pushing forward and finally led to the actual pulling of a lanyard at Fort Sumter.
Right. We welcome phone calls for both our guests. Today, 151 years ago, the Civil War began in Fort Sumter, and we're talking about the Civil War this hour, and particularly what happened in this country 151 years ago. Rick Hatcher is a historian at the Fort Sumter National Monument, which is where he joins us today. And he says by this time of the day, there was a lot of fighting going on. Lance Hertigan is chair of the Wisconsin Civil War 150th Commission and former director of the Institute of Civil War Studies at Carroll University. His latest book is Those Damned Black Hats, the Iron Brigade in the Gettysburg Campaign. Here's our phone number. Join the conversation, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We also have an email address you can use, which is talk@wpr.org. And we've also put a question on our Facebook page today for asking for you to tell us the stories that have been told in your family about your ancestors' participation in the Civil War. I'm always amazed to hear those stories, and we'll read some of them. To your phone calls in a moment, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to Ralph in Little Suamico as our first caller. Hi, Ralph.
Yes. Good morning, Kathleen, and your historian guests.
Good morning, Ralph.
Good morning.
I visited Fort Sumter, and when I was there thinking about it a little bit, I was really surprised at how little a pacifist-type view on this conflict is. Very seldom do you hear anybody say, what if the U.S. government would have said, okay, we're pulling out. Fort Sumter is yours. And basically just allowed the Confederacy to go ahead. We probably would have not had slavery right now. If we would have, we would have been the only country. There's been dozens of countries where slavery just disappeared without all the loss of life and violence that this took. And to just think of the terrible millions of people that died or suffered because they were playing a political game. And I think eventually what would have happened is that the South and the North would have worked together. The South was an agricultural area. The North was a manufacturing area. And they would have become very dependent on each other. And I think we could have done this without the terrible destruction that was caused.
What do you think, though, Ralph, would have happened to slavery? Would it have continued for many more years to come?
It didn't in other countries. There were dozens of countries that had slavery, and they all basically, it just disappeared because, you know, for example, with cotton, which was the main crop, it wasn't that much years long, not many years past then, that Eli Whitney invented the cotton gin, that there were pickers out in the field, mechanical pickers. The need for all those slaves would have gone away economically.
All right. Rick, what do you say?
Well, also along that line, you've got, you know, England was a large producer of cotton, and with the development of cotton in their crown colony, India, then that would have been less demand for a southern cotton crop going into England. They could have gotten more from their colony in India. So, you know, that would have maybe had some impact as well upon this issue of there being less demand for southern cotton from the United States, but coming in from other areas in the world as that develops. So you can start to get some of a global, you know, economic concept of this as well. It could play a factor.
Lance, what do you think of this?
I don't know. It's a tough question. I don't think slavery would have went away as easy as it sounds, or the way we would like to think of it. As late as 1863, now that's the middle of the war, a Kentucky slave owner was in Wisconsin with 25 slaves and offered them up to help with harvest in the Wisconsin farms. It was a strange mix, and I'm not so sure the economics of it would have gone away easily. I'm not so sure the war could have been avoided by Lincoln just rolling over and saying, well, take Fort Sumter, take whatever, Godspeed and go. But he did need a military action to rouse the country in the North and to fight the war. And I think he was willing to do that. Lincoln's a strange guy in many ways. He's very intelligent. He's always running about 6 months ahead of everybody else in the public consciousness.
Yes, and always has been, remains that way. I don't think, from what I've read about his deliberations, his writing prior to this, that he ever really entertained the thought that he was just going to let him go. Do you, Rick?
No, oh, go ahead, Rick.
I agree. I don't think he was. If he had allowed that, it would probably have been, he would have been a one-term president, probably, and it could have been the end of the Republican Party. So once again, we're getting into the area of what historians like to call counterfactual history, where we speculate on what may have happened if history had turned down a different path, or there had been a different decision
right.
made here or there. So, we can't change history, as we all know, but, there's this counterfactual argument, the what ifs. And so, we can, and this has been talked about, for over 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
The what ifs, in various aspects of our nation's history, world history. So now we're kind of in this counterfactual area of the what if situation. What if Lincoln had said Anderson to evacuate Sumter, and we won't have any combat here? How would it have gone from that point? We just simply don't know.
What we didn't know as well, though, Lance, was what was ahead, how bloody it was going to be, how it ripped this nation apart. We just didn't know how awful this was.
We were so innocent. I think I always like to think that it was the last real innocence of America in some ways, because after that we were a much more sophisticated and cynical people. But they went to war with a whoop and a holler and bands playing and drums and fifes and cheers, and everybody was excited to go. They thought the war would be over, one great battle, everybody would be home by fall. So off they went.
So off they went. Thanks, Ralph, for your call. Margie in Butternut. Hi, Margie.
Hi.
Hi.
I was just calling to let you know that my grandfather was actually one of the people that fought in Virginia. The other thing that I wanted to let you know is that we were taught in school in North Carolina that Mecklenburg County was the first county to secede the Union. And I just wondered if you could verify that one way or another, and I will take my answer off the air.
Before you go, Margie, did your grandfather talk about being in the war?
My grandfather, unfortunately, failed in Virginia. He never came back from the war.
Mm.
I have documentation as far as we could go back and stuff. And he had came to America from England at some point in time. And then he married my great-great-great-grandmother. I mean, it was several greats. I'm not sure exactly how many. So,
mm-hmm.
So he did not give us any information because he died before. I mean, and he never mm-hmm. never returned back.
Mm. Rick, what do you know about that county in North Carolina?
Well, there are several places that want to claim to be first. There is in Abbeville, South Carolina. The folks there claim that that's where the first movement was for secession in their county that led on to South Carolina's secession. I'm not exactly sure with the situation in Mecklenburg County, North Carolina, but during the American Revolution, there are folks in North Carolina who claim that they had the first movement for independence from Great Britain there in North Carolina. So, there are several places that claim, this first movement or this first interest. And the one I'm most familiar with is the one in Abbeville, South Carolina.
Mm. When did the first Wisconsin troops enter the war, and where did they fight, Lance?
Well, the first regiment was called in by Governor Alexander Randall. It was a 90-day regiment, meaning that they enlisted for 90 days, and it was mustered in Milwaukee at a place they called Camp Scott, which is right now around where Marquette University is, in that area there.
Oh.
They went east to the war front, and they ended up fighting in a battle at Falling Waters,
in Maryland roughly a couple, several weeks just before the Battle of Bull Run. Then they came home. They were back in Wisconsin by August, remustered for another 3 years, and went back into the war and served in the West. So those 90-day troops were literally came out of Milwaukee and went east.
Hmm. Is there a marker somewhere in Milwaukee that shows that?
No, I don't think there is. There's a couple of places marking the you know, the various camps. There were four major military camps in Milwaukee.
There should be. There should...
The first one was Camp Scott, named after Winfield Scott, the commander of the Union armies at that time. And it was the first commander was a man by the name of Charles Starkweather, who was a very prominent Milwaukee attorney and active in a militia unit called the Milwaukee Light Guard, which was one of the most famous militia units of the Middle West.
Hmm. Somebody should put a marker there. It's important. We'll have to call Marquette and tell him to do that. Is it true, I have read that in the fire that took place, all the gun shooting that took place in Fort Sumter, nobody was killed?
No one was killed on either side during the 34-hour bombardment.
Wow.
There were a few soldiers on both sides who had some slight injuries. The only known death in the bombardment was a Confederate officer's horse that was struck by a cannonball.
How could that happen with such fierce fighting going on?
Well, it gives you an idea of how good the fortifications were, and how good the officers were on both sides to take care and protect their troops. The best example is Major Robert Anderson in command of Fort Sumter. The fort had three tiers of cannons, and the first tier, the ground tier, was the safest. So he ordered his men to just load and fire the cannon that were in the first tier of casemated gun rooms in the fort, the most protected. And that's one of the reasons probably he didn't receive any casualties or deaths from the bombardment. So, you know, that's just an example.
Robert in Mauston. Hi, Robert.
Hi. You know, what interests me is I think a couple of years before the Civil War, when Lincoln was in Congress, he was dead set against adding Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, and California to the United States, right? He didn't go for the Mexican War. But he sacrificed 500,000 Americans to keep those seven Confederate states in the Union, which it seems kind of interesting to me how, you know, one balancing one against the other. The other thing I'd like to comment on, was there any reason for the U.S. to invade Canada and make up for the War of 1812?
All right, who wants to take it?
I'm ducking out of that one.
I'm primarily a military historian, not a political historian. But, you know, there was some effort on it one time in during the war to see about invading Mexico because of Maximilian being there, and to and from the United, you know, from the United States perspective, I can't remember which United States politician thought of that and said we could send emissaries into the Confederacy and say, rejoin us so we will invade Mexico and drive the French out of there, and kind of based on the Monroe Doctrine concept. So that was even bandied around at one time by at least a United States politician during the Civil War. Oh, we'll get the Confederacy to give up this war thing between us and the United States and the Confederacy, and we'll reunite and go invade Mexico to try to get the nation back together. So, you know, there were, you know, people out there thinking, being very imaginative in their ideas.
Thank you, Robert, for the call. Yeah, go ahead, Lance.
I'm not convinced that that Lincoln knew that the war was going to turn into what it did. So when you try to say, let's balance, you know, what happened to what might have happened, he was not aware of that. They thought the war would end fairly quickly, I believe, on both sides. And as a result of it, we're kind of doing that look back and say, well, if this happened, that happened, we'd get away with it. But, you know, there's no way of knowing that in 1861.
Mm-hmm.
And Lincoln also had to play this balancing act between Maryland, Kentucky, and Missouri. if he lost, especially Missouri and Kentucky, Missouri was the eighth most populated state in the nation. At the time, it was the main route to go west, the California-Oregon Trail, the Santa Fe Trail, the Butterfield Overland Trail, the Pony Express. We're all going, you know, based in Missouri for the most part. If he loses Missouri and then Kentucky, then he is, the Confederacy is probably going to become a reality. So very early in the war, he is really on this tightrope and has to be very, very careful in the course of action that he's going to follow. And let's say, and we're still, and after Fort Sumter, once again, no one has been killed on either side in this first major combat action of the war. So, you know, there's a few out there who are still holding onto this faint, rapidly fading possibility that maybe there won't be an actual war, that we won't go into a full-blown war. But, of course, we know that doesn't happen. We do go into a horrendous warfare.
More phone calls whenever you'd like to call us, and we have a couple people on hold. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. We're also asking, we have this Facebook page, and we're asking if you have ancestors who served in the war or your next-door neighbors, stories that have been passed down through the generations. If you'd like to post those, we'd like to read some of them on the air. And it's also something, once this show is gone, you can read those memories on our Facebook page. That's the Kathleen Dunn Show. We have two guests with us on this day 151 years ago at Fort Sumter. The first shots were fired in the Civil War, and thus it began. And we're talking about it this hour of the show. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's a Facebook message that has come in, gentlemen, from Jane. The grandfather of an older friend was the last Civil War veteran from Antioch, Illinois, when my friend's father lost his hearing and could not work any longer as a salesman. The entire family of grandfather, husband and wife and two sons, lived solely on the elder gentleman's Civil War pension well into the 20th century.
That gets very rare. When I was at Wilson's Creek National Battlefield in Missouri, I was contacted by United States Senator Danforth, who was doing research on a lady who was celebrating her 100th birthday, and she was the widow of a Union soldier. And during research at the time in the 1990s, there was a handful of widows of Union soldiers and some dependent children of Union soldiers who were still receiving pensions on their husband's or father's service in the Union Army.
My goodness. Do you know what that pension was, Lance?
It varied depending on whether the veteran was injured or not and how ill he was. You had to prove that you could only work 3 hours a day before you were eligible for a pension. In other words, that you were physically disabled to a certain degree. I've heard, so the number varies, $12 a month up to $15. There was always pressure to raise the pensions of soldiers, and of course that was a great political force in the 1880s and 90s.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Courtney in Ashland. Hi, Courtney.
Hi there. I had mentioned that I just started listening about 15 minutes ago, and I wasn't sure if this topic was covered or not. But I was wondering if there's anybody available to kind of explore the Native American influence and involvement in the Civil War. I know they, you know, fought heavily within the Confederacy, but I think that topic is really looked over a lot when we talk about the Civil War, and I'm just wondering if there's anybody there that can talk about that a little bit.
Oh, I'm sure there is. Lance?
I'm off and running. I'm fascinated by the Native American story, and at least in the upper Middle West, because so many Native Americans served in Union regiments in Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, and ended up in battles in Virginia and all over. They initially were not allowed to enlist because it was considered to be a white man's fight. And it wasn't until 1863 that actual Native Americans were allowed to go into Union regiments.
So most of the Native Americans in the upper Midwest called themselves French Canadians and enlisted that way. And it was a hard time on the reservations. They were, the times were not good, a lot of illness. There was a lot of food was tight. So as a result, young men were going into the Army, one, because of their warrior tradition, two, to prove that they were loyal members of the state, and three, just to help provide for their families.
Hmm. That's fascinating.
Now, on the southern side, there was the famous Stan Waddy, who was a Confederate brigadier general. They were out of the Indian Territory of Oklahoma, and there was a brigade of Cherokee Choctaws that were actually participated in the Battle of Pea Ridge, or Elkhorn Tavern, in Arkansas in March of 1862.
Yeah, that's a good. I think he was the last Confederate general to surrender.
I believe you're correct there.
It's after the war.
Hmm. The Fort Sumter fell on April 13. What were the terms of surrender? I have heard that they were generous and that there was a 100-gun salute before Anderson and his men evacuated the fort. Is that true?
Yes, there have been negotiations between Anderson and Beauregard for the evacuation of the fort. And Beauregard said, you know, you'll be allowed to take your personal property with you, and we will allow you to be transported anywhere to the north that you want to go. And so those terms that were offered for evacuation before the bombardment were honored after the bombardment, and the official surrender takes place on April 14th, 1861. And as part of that, Anderson had requested to fire a 100-gun salute to the nation and to the United States flag. Unfortunately, on the 47th round being loaded, that gun discharged prematurely.
Ooh.
And Private Daniel Howe, who was loading the gun, was killed.
Oh.
And so the first soldier to die in the American Civil War was during this surrender ceremony and this honor salute, and he was buried on the parade ground of Fort Sumter. A second soldier was injured also during this incident, and he died about a day later. And so the first two soldiers to die in the Civil Wars as a result after the combat had started were these two soldiers, and they were both from Ireland, who were immigrants who had joined the United States Army.
Oh, my.
One from Tipperary, and the other one was from Cork.
Huh.
Yeah, you know, I should say this, that Fort Sumter is one of the great places to visit if you're interested.
Yes, it is.
Beautiful location, fun to go out there. When I went there for the first time, I was struck how small it was and what a great war had grown out of a pretty small facility.
Do you have a lot of visitors?
Yes, ma'am, we do. In fact, last year we had 368,000 visit Fort Sumter. It was the biggest visitation year we've ever had.
Mm-hmm.
And we're running ahead this year. For the first quarter, we're running ahead of last year's visitation figures.
Hmm. Well, with the 150th anniversary, that will go on for some time, won't it?
Yes, ma'am.
It's just a great facility to visit and just to stand there and try to imagine what it was like 151 years ago.
Yeah. Right. That's what's on my mind all day today, that's for sure. What it was like 150 years ago, 151. Irv is next. Hi, Irv.
Hello. How are you?
All right, Irv. How are you?
I'm fine.
Good.
I find this program to be extremely interesting. I'm on a committee in Boscobel, Wisconsin, and every fall, the first weekend in August, we have a Civil War reenactment. Civil War era reenactment. A lot of the townsfolk take part. They dress up in civilian attire from the era, and we have close to 1,000 reenactors that come and participate. It takes place on a park. It's a huge park. I'm guessing probably 10 acres. We have 40-50 horses. They have 25 cannon, and it's just a living history in the first weekend in August, and I just thought that your listeners might want to know about that if they want to get a little piece of history and relive it.
Yeah, that's a great event. I've been to it many times, and I always enjoy going to Boscobel, which has one of the the last surviving Grand Army of the Republic Hall in Wisconsin, which was, of course, the Veterans Movement after the war.
I would imagine, because I see reenactors, and I've seen many of them, and we hear from many of them, that Wisconsin has a lot of reenactors, Lance.
Yeah, they have some pretty good units. A lot of them go out east. A big group of them just got back from the reenactment of Shiloh, which is the 150th anniversary of that. And we have some very interesting units. They're very careful with their detail and authentic in many ways. And, of course, we have a great event at Boscobel, and then we have another great reenactment at the Waite House late in September, which is the State Historical Society site. So we have two pretty good events every year in Wisconsin.
So I want to know what happened in the month after today, 151 years ago. How did the president take in this news? How did he decide what the response was going to be? How did he rally the Union? What happened?
Well, I can talk about Wisconsin. Basically, what the Governor Alexander Randall, who was our first Republican governor and a legislator from Waukesha, Wisconsin. In fact, his home in Waukesha is part of the Carroll University complex right now. He called the first regiment out. Wisconsin was given a quota of one regiment, as I mentioned before. But he quickly began to organize a second and a third and a fourth regiment because he realized that the war was going to go on. The difficulty, of course, is each state had to equip regiments as they were formed, except for firearms and weapons. In other words, they had to do uniforms and all of that. So there was this ongoing conclave of trying to find enough wool, trying to find enough leather, trying to find enough shoes, belts. What's interesting, of course, is that Wisconsin's first eight regiments went in militia gray, because gray was the color of militia units in the country at the time. So they were organizing right away. Randall said, this war started where at South Carolina, and it'll end where South Carolina was. So he was pretty upset. They were driving it pretty hard.
Mm-hmm.
You look at it, in 1860, the entire United States Army was only about 16,000 strong. So,
wow.
So you've got this massive buildup. You have to have this large expanse of the War Department to handle, the quartermaster stores, commissary, medical department. It's just tremendous. And it's going to take a while to do this. And the Confederacy's in the same situation where they're trying to establish an entire government, a Secretary of State, a Secretary of War,
mm-hmm.
and get postal service, a navy.
Oh,
so they're trying to start and form a government from scratch and get on a war footing at the same time. So
yeah, we should mention that it was a state effort in a lot of ways too. Why don't you talk a little about that?
Well, yeah, across north and south, these states, as I said, the call goes out for states to provide troops, so they're forming all these organizations on the state level. So it goes down to communities and counties, forming companies of soldiers, and they're trying to outfit the men from their county, from their community. Uniforms are being designed, flags are being made, tents, it's just everything. So, and then they have to go to these mustering points, generally maybe near the state capital or a large city, and these companies of 100 soldiers each come in, and they have to be formed into regiments, generally of 10 companies to a regiment, and then regiments are gathered together into brigades, and you've got all this transportation. They have to be taken to the seat of war. They have to go through training to learn this linear military tactics to get 1,000 men to operate together as one on a field of battle. So it's this tremendous buildup and learning curve on both sides, and it takes a while to do that. And, of course, then, as you know, up north, we had this great clamoring on to Richmond, where the newspapers and people are saying, you got to go, and you got to, and it's only 100 miles from Washington to Richmond. So, send the Union Army, down and stamp out the rebellion.
Let's go. Yes, go ahead, Lance.
I should mention that one of the companies that was formed was called out of Vernon County, which was then Bad Axe County, was called the Anderson Guards after Major Anderson of Fort Sumter.
Mm. Oh, we have so many more phone calls, and I better not take them because otherwise we'll be jammed with time. Gentlemen, what do you recommend we read today so we can get more steeped in the history of this day?
I would recommend Days of Defiance by Maury Klein. That is a very good book that covers the politics and the situation from the election of Lincoln, and it covers the North and the South leading up to and through the military situation and the bombardment of Fort Sumter.
Great.
That would be a great book.
All right. And Lance? You got to read Lance's book.
My old books. Yeah.
It's a good one. That's all right.
but I'll try to be humble. a book I love a lot is a book called If This Be War by a man named Alan Gaff, and it's The Raising of the Second Wisconsin and Their Adventures at Bull Run.
Oh, thank you, gentlemen, so much. Thanks for being with us. You're a wealth of information. I'm so sorry to end this hour. I could talk to you all day on the air, and it would just be endlessly fascinating. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
Hey, it was fun.
Thank you. Nobody calls me ma'am. That's a first. That's all right, huh? Rick Hatcher, historian for Fort Sumter National Monument. Lance Hertigan, chair of the Wisconsin Civil War 150th Commission. His book, Those Damn Black Hats, the Iron Brigade and the Gettysburg Campaign. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the show and to Brett Jaspers for on-air production.